few days earlier, I had had a dream. I dreamt that I awoke to find myself lying on a remote beach, spread-eagled on huge, round, pink and pale blue boulders, and unable to move, my head filled with the slow roar of the sea. I awoke from this dream to find myself lying spread-eagled on huge, round, pink and pale blue boulders, on a beach and dazed with confusion. I couldn't move because my camera bag was slung around my neck and jammed behind a boulder. I struggled to my feet and looked out to sea, trying to work out where on earth I was, and if I was still embroiled in a recursion of dreams. Perhaps I was still on a plane going somewhere and was just watching an in-flight movie. I looked around for a stewardess, but there was no one coming along the beach with a tray of drinks. I looked down at my boots, and that seemed to trigger something in my head. The last clear memory that came to mind of looking closely at my boots was after emerging from a bog in Zaire, when they were sodden with African mud. I looked around nervously. There were no rhinoceroses on the beach either. The beach was clearly not in Zaire, because Zaire is landlocked and doesn't have them. I looked at my boots again. They seemed oddly clean. How had that happened? I remembered someone taking my boots away from me and cleaning them. Why would anyone do that? And who? An airport came swimming back to me, and I remembered being questioned about my boots and where I had been with them. Zaire, I said. They took my boots away and returned them to me a few minutes later, spotlessly clean and glistening with disinfectant. I remembered thinking at the time that any time I wanted to have my boots really clean properly, I should remember to fly to New Zealand again. New Zealand. They were quite naturally paranoid about any foreign bacteria being imported into one of the most isolated and unspoilt countries in the world. I tried to remember flying out of New Zealand, and couldn't. Therefore, I must still be in New Zealand. Good. I'd narrowed it down a bit. But where? I stumbled a little woozily up the beach, clambering over the boulders of quietly hallucinatory colours, and then from my new vantage point saw Mark away in the distance on his knees and peering into an old log. "Molting little blue penguin," he said, when at last I reached him. "What?" I said. "Where?" "In the log," he said. "Look." I peered into the log. A small pair of black eyes peered anxiously back at me from out of a dark ball of ruffled blue fluff. I sat back heavily on a rock. "Very nice," I said. "Where are we?" Mark grinned. "I thought you seemed a bit jet-lagged," he said. "You've been asleep for about 20 minutes. "Okay," I said irritably, "but where are we? I think I've narrowed it down to New Zealand." "Little Barrier Island," he said. "Remember, we came here this morning by helicopter." "Ah," I said. "So that answers my next question. It's the afternoon, yes?" "Yes," said Mark. "It's about 4 o'clock, and we are expected for tea." I looked up and down the beach again, thunderstruck by this idea. "Tea," I said. "With Mike and Dobby."
"Who?"
"Well, just pretend you know them when we get there, because you spent an hour chatting to them this morning."
"I did?"
"Dobby is the warden of the island."
"And Mike?"
"His wife."
"I see."
I thought for a bit.
"I know," I said suddenly.
"We've come to look for the kakapo, yes?"
"Correct."
"Will we find one here?"
"Doubt it."
"Then remind me, why are we here?"
"Because this is one of the only two places where there are definitely kakapos living."
"But we probably won't find one," I said.
"No."
"But we will at least get some tea."
"Yes."
"Well, let's go and get some. Tell me all about it again on the way, but slowly."
"Okay," said Mark. He took a few last pictures of the little blue penguin, a bird which I was destined never to find out anything more about, packed away his Nikons, and together we set off back to the warden's lodge.
"Now that New Zealand is riddled with predators of all kinds," said Mark, "the only possible refuge for kakapos is on islands, and protected islands at that. Stewart Island in the south, where one or two kakapos are still found, is inhabited and no longer even remotely safe. Any kakapos that are found there are trapped and airlifted to Codfish Island, which is just nearby. They are studded and protected there. In fact, they're so well protected that there's a certain amount of doubt at the moment whether we'll even be allowed to go there. Apparently there's some furore going on at DOC about..."
"DOC?" I said.
"The New Zealand Department of Conservation. There's a disagreement about whether they'll let us go there. On the one hand, there's a feeling that we might do some good by getting some publicity for the project. On the other hand, there's a feeling that the birds should not be disturbed on any account.
There's only one person available who could help us find the bird, and he doesn't want to take us at all.
Who is he?
A freelance kakapo tracker called Arab.
I see.
He has a kakapo tracking dog.
Sounds like the sort of person we need. Is there a lot of work for freelance kakapo trackers? I mean, there aren't a lot of kakapos to track, are there?
40. In fact, there are 3 or 4 kakapo trackers.
And 3 or 4 kakapo tracking dogs?
Exactly. The dogs are specially trained to sniff out the kakapos. They wear muzzles so they won't harm the birds. They've been used to trap the kakapos on Stewart Island so they can then be airlifted to Codfish Island and here to Little Barrier Island by helicopter. First time any of the species have flown at all for thousands, perhaps millions of years.
What does a kakapo tracker do when there aren't any kakapos that need tracking?
Kills cats.
Out of frustration?
No, Codfish Island was infested with feral cats. In other words, cats that have returned to the wild.
I always think that's an artificial distinction, I said. I think all cats are wild cats. They just act tame if they think they'll get a saucer of milk out of it.
So they kill cats on Codfish Island.
Killed them, said Mark, every last one.
And all the possums and stoats. Anything that moved and wasn't a bird, essentially. It's not very pleasant, but that's how the island was originally, and that's the only way kakapos can survive in exactly the environment that New Zealand had before man arrived, with no predators. They did the same here on Little Barrier Island, too.
At that moment, something happened which I found a little startling, until I realised that it had already happened once that day, only in my befuddled, jet-lagged state, I had completely forgotten about it. Coming from the beach, we had trudged through thick undergrowth and along rough, muddy tracks across a couple of fields full of sheep, and suddenly emerged into a garden. Not just a garden, but a garden that was meticulously grown and manicured, with immaculate flower beds, well-kempt trees, and shrubs, rockeries, and a little stream with a natty little bridge over it. The effect was that of walking into a slightly suburban Garden of Eden, as if on the 8th day God had suddenly got going again and started creating flymos, secateurs, and those things I can never remember the name of, but are essentially electrically driven pieces of string. And there, stepping out onto the lawn, was Mike, the warden's wife, with a tray full of tea things, which I fell upon with loud exclamations of delight and hello. Meanwhile, I had lost Mark altogether. He was standing only a few feet away, but he had gone into a glazed trance, which I decided I would go and investigate after I had got to grips with some serious tea. He was probably looking at the birds, of which there seemed to be quite a lot in the garden. I chatted cheerfully to Mike, reintroduced myself to her as the vaguely Neanderthal creature she had probably encountered lumbering in a lost daze from the helicopter that morning, and asked her how she coped with living, as she and Dobby had done for 11.5 years, entirely isolated on this island, apart from the occasional nature-loving tourist. She explained that they had quite a few nature-loving tourists a day, and the worry was that there were too many of them. It is so horribly easy to introduce predators onto the island by mistake, and the damage would be very serious. The tourists who came on organised trips could be managed quite carefully, but the danger came from people coming over to the island on boats and setting up barbies on the beach. All it would take could be a few rats or a pregnant cat, and the work of years would be undone. I was surprised at the thought that anyone thinking of taking a barbecue to an island beach would necessarily think of including a pregnant cat in their party, but she assured me it could happen very easily, and virtually every type of boat has rats aboard. She was a cheerful, sprightly, and robust woman, and I very much suspected that the iron will which had been imposed on the rugged terrain of the island to turn this acre of it into a ferociously manicured garden was hers. Gaynor emerged from the neat white clapboard house at this moment with Dobby, whom she had been interviewing on tape. Dobby had originally come to the island 11.5 years earlier as part of the cat-killing program, and stayed on as warden of the reserve, a post from which he was going to have to retire in 18 months. He was not looking forward to this at all. From where they were standing in their domain of miniature paradise, a little house in a mainland town seemed desperately constrained and humdrum. We chatted for a little while more, and then Gaynor approached Mark to record a description of the garden onto tape, but he gestured her curtly away and returned to the trance he had been in for several minutes now. This seemed rather odd behaviour from Mark, who was usually a man of mild and genial manners, and I asked him what was up. He muttered something briefly about birds and continued to ignore us. I looked around again. There certainly were a lot of birds in the garden. I have to make a confession here. It's going to sound a little odd coming from someone who has travelled 12,000 miles and back to visit a parrot. But I'm actually not tremendously excited by birds. There are all sorts of things about birds that I find interesting, I suppose, but the things themselves don't really get to me. Hippopotamuses, yes, I'm happy to stare at a hippopotamus till the hippo itself gets bored and wanders away in bemusement. Gorillas, lemurs, dolphins, I will watch entranced for hours, hypnotised as much as anything else by their eyes. But show me a garden full of some of the most exotic birds in the world, and I'll be just as happy to stand around drinking tea and chatting to people. It gradually dawned on me that this is probably exactly what was happening. "This," said Mark at last in a low, hollow voice, "is..." I waited patiently.
"Amazing,"
he said at last. Eventually, Gaynor prevailed on him to bring himself back from his trance, and he started to talk excitedly about the tuis, the New Zealand pigeons, the bellbirds, the North Island robins, the New Zealand kingfisher, the red-crowned parakeets, the paradise shell ducks, and the great crowd of large kakas which were swooping around the garden and jostling each other at the bird bath. I felt vaguely depressed and also a little fraudulent at being unable to share his excitement. And that evening I fell to wondering why it was that I was so intensely keen to find and see a kakapo, and so little bothered by all the other birds. I think it's flightlessness. There's something gripping about the idea that this creature has actually given up doing something that virtually every human being has yearned to do since the very first of us looked upwards. I think I find other birds rather irritating for the cocky ease with which they flit through the air as if it was nothing. I can remember once coming face to face with a free-roaming emu years ago in Sydney Zoo. You are strongly warned not to approach them too closely, because they can be pretty violent creatures. But once I had caught its eye, I found its irate staring face absolutely riveting, because once you look one right in the eye, you have a sudden sense of what the effect has been on the creature of having all the disadvantages of being a bird. Absurd posture, a hopelessly scruffy covering of useless feathers, and two useless limbs, without actually being able to do the thing that birds should be able to do, which is to fly. It becomes instantly clear that the bird has gone barking mad. Here, to digress for a moment, is a little-known fact. One of the more dangerous animals in Africa is, surprisingly enough, the ostrich. Deaths due to ostriches do not excite the public imagination very much, because they're essentially so undignified. Ostriches do not bite because they do not have teeth. They don't tear you to pieces because they don't have any forelimbs with claws on them. No, ostriches kick you to death. And who, frankly, can blame them? The kakapo, though, is not an angry or violent bird. It pursues its own eccentricities rather industriously and modestly. If you ask anybody who has worked with kakapos to describe them, they tend to use words like innocent and solemn, even when it's leaping helplessly out of a tree. This I find immensely appealing. I asked Dobby if they'd given names to the kakapos on the island, and he instantly came up with four of them. Matthew, Luke, John, and Snark. These seem to be good names for a group of solemnly batty birds. And then there's the other matter. It's not merely the fact that it's given up that which we all so intensely desire. It's also the fact that it has made a terrible mistake, which makes it so compelling. This is a bird you can warm to. I wanted very much to find one.